Hi, I'm Rob Nadelson. This commentary addresses two of the most persistent criticisms of the Constitution. First, that it was adopted to protect or at least accommodate slavery. And second, that the so-called Three-Fifths Compromise was based upon racist assumptions. In this commentary, I explain why those criticisms are historically false. Critics of the Constitution point out that perhaps 25 of the Constitution's 55 framers, that is, those who actually wrote or drafted the document, were slaveholders. But this statistic is deceptive. One reason it's deceptive is that it omits a countervailing factor. The Constitutional Convention also included influential opponents of slavery. John Dickinson inherited bondsmen, but freed them all. Benjamin Franklin, James Wilson, and Gouverneur Morris, among others, were abolitionists. And even among the minority who held slaves, some, such as James Madison, favored gradual emancipation. As a result, there was much criticism of slavery at the Constitutional Convention, and only the delegates from South Carolina offered even a lukewarm defense. Another reason this statistic is deceptive is that the framers comprised only a tiny segment of those who actually adopted the Constitution into law. The people who did that were the 1,648 state ratifying convention delegates. More than that, if you add in the subsequent ratification by the state of Vermont. The overwhelming majority of those delegates, exactly how many is not clear, but likely more than 90%, did not own slaves. Additionally, most leading participants in the debates over the Constitution's ratification were not slaveholders. For example, Noah Webster, an advocate of the Constitution who was later famous as the author of the first great American Dictionary, was an abolitionist. And finally, there were the tens of thousands of voters who selected the state convention delegates. Perhaps 95% of those voters own no slaves. Now let's go back and look at some additional historical context. During the founding generation, most thoughtful people in the English-speaking world believed that slavery violated natural law. In fact, the English-speaking peoples were the first major demographic group in history to abolish the institution of slavery. This process was well underway when the Constitution was written. In 1772, 15 years before the Constitutional Convention, the Court of King's Bench in England decided the case of Somerset versus Stuart. This case banished slavery forever from the English homeland. Soon after American independence in 1776, 10 of the 13 states abolished the slave trade, and one of those states, North Carolina, imposed steep taxes on it. Several states also began general emancipation, and five states granted the vote to free African Americans. That's why Constitutional Convention delegate Roger Sherman of Connecticut remarked that, quote, "The abolition of slavery seems to be going on in the United States, and the good sense of the several states will probably by degree complete it," end quote. His Connecticut colleague, Oliver Ellsworth, later Chief Justice of the United States, predicted that, quote, "slavery in time will not be a speck in our country." Sherman and Ellsworth were expressing the common view that slavery in America was on the way to extinction. Tragically, those subscribing to that view did not foresee the invention of the cotton gin. Despite the trends against slavery in 1787, it remained clear that the elite in a few states were clinging to it, and they wouldn't approve a constitution that curbed it. For example, South Carolina delegate Charles Cotesworth Pinckney said that if the Constitution abolished slavery, the Constitution would be rejected by South Carolina and Georgia. The framers were forced to conclude that a constitution curbing slavery couldn't unify the country and might even fail the 9-state ratification threshold. And unity was critical because the probable result of disunion would be never-ending war on the American continent. Now, the common cause against Great Britain had tied together colonies that never had much to do with each other previously. But by 1787, this connection that had arisen from the common cause against Great Britain was unraveling. The Confederation Congress was widely ignored. Rhode Island and Connecticut were in a creditor-debtor dispute that threatened to resort to arms. Many spoke of dividing the country into several confederations, with some states remaining entirely independent. On the costs and potential results of disunity, European history was very instructive. The previous 150 years had witnessed about 70, that's 70 European wars, in addition to rebellions, and the results were horrific. The 30 Years' War, which ended in 1648, may have killed directly or indirectly as many as 8 million people. The War of the Austrian Succession, 1740 to 48, resulted in perhaps 500,000 casualties. The 7 Years' War between 1756 and 1763 caused perhaps 1 million casualties. Had a similar scenario been imported to America, it's likely that slaves, being at the bottom of the social hierarchy, probably would have suffered even more than free people. When Governor Edmund Randolph introduced his Virginia plan to the convention, he emphasized that the Articles of Confederation couldn't protect against foreign invasion, couldn't prevent states from provoking foreign powers, and couldn't prevent interstate conflict. To do that, a stronger government was necessary. During the public debates on the Constitution, an important part of the advocates' successful argument was the need for unity to avoid war. Although I believe modern writers rely too heavily on the Federalist Papers when searching for constitutional meaning, those essays do offer a good sample of the arguments for unity. You can find those arguments in Federalist No. 4 and 5 by John Jay, in No. 6 by Alexander Hamilton, and in No. 41 by James Madison. Madison argued that foreign nations could intervene in a disunited America to turn American states against each other, and that, quote, the fortunes of disunited America will be even more disastrous than those of Europe. And he made this point because Europe didn't have some outside continent meddling in its affairs the way Europe could meddle in American affairs. Also, in Federalist No. 45, Madison argued, the Union is essential to the security of the people of America against foreign danger and essential to their security against contentions among the different states. So before criticizing the founders for permitting the states to allow slavery, we have to understand the choice they faced. On the one hand, they could tolerate a vile institution that seemed to be dying anyway, or on the other hand, they could consign the American continent to perpetual warfare at a cost of millions of lives and incalculable misery, both among free people and among slaves. One more point on this. Although critics attacked the Constitution in part because some slaveholders advocated it, the fact that there were also many slaveholders who opposed the Constitution. So if the Constitution is somehow tarred because a minority of its supporters were slaveholders, then critics of the Constitution are also tarred by the fact that the Constitution was opposed by slaveholders such as Virginia's Richard Henry Lee and North Carolina's Willie Jones. There is also a claim that the Constitution stems from and continues to reflect systemic racism. To support this charge, critics point to Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3. This is called the Three-Fifths Compromise. Critics dwell on the Three-Fifths Compromise, even though it actually was amended out of the Constitution more than 150 years ago. But here are some examples of their charge. In 2011, a Time magazine cover story asserted, and I'm quoting here, "The framers gave us the idea that a black person was three-fifths of a human being." 10 years later, in 2021, Time doubled down with a column stating that the Constitution defined African Americans as only three-fifths of a person, end quote. Similarly, a Teen Vogue item misinformed its young readers with these words, and I'm quoting again, "White supremacy is systemic. It thrives in politics with systems like the Electoral College, a process originally designed to protect the influence of white slaveholders, which is still used today to determine presidential elections because enslaved black people were declared three-fifths of a person in order to strengthen the power of the white men who kept them in bondage." I have to tell you, as all my listeners, this is simply historical drivel. The truth is that the Constitution's text was racially neutral. The framers employed the same word, person, or the word inhabitant, to refer to humans of all races. They rejected the racial qualifications for voting and office holding that marred some state constitutions. For all purposes, the Constitution treated Indians who paid taxes and the significant number of free African Americans who lived in America at that time, treated them exactly the same as it treated white people. So what was the Three-Fifths Compromise, and what was the basis of the charge that it was racist? The Three-Fifths Compromise addressed two issues. One was the size of each state's delegation in the House of Representatives, how many representatives each state got. The other issue was each state's contribution of federal direct taxes. Direct taxes are levies imposed on individual persons, such as capitations or head taxes, and also taxes imposed on a wide range of items such as property, income, wealth, and professions. Direct taxes were distinguished from indirect taxes, which were primarily levies on consumption and on transportation of goods across political boundaries. Now, the Constitution provided that every state would have at least one representative in the House of Representatives. The Three-Fifths Compromise added that both the additional representatives and direct taxes would be split among the states according to their population. But for those purposes only, each state's population figure would be reduced to exclude, quote, Indians not taxed, and secondly, to rate each slave as three-fifths of a free person. Now, if you assume that counting persons is the proper basis for congressional representation, it's easy to see how you could misread the reduction for slaves and the exclusion of non-taxpaying Indians as expressions of racism. However, many, probably most of the framers, did not think counting persons was the proper basis for representation. They believe representation should follow the ability to contribute federal tax revenue. This view was inherited from English history. Remember the Revolutionary War slogan, "No taxation without representation"? But when the framers tried to find a formula for calculating each state's ability to contribute tax revenue, they ran into practical difficulties. After rejecting several proposed formulas as unworkable, they conceded that over the long run, a state's tax capacity would correlate with its population. As James Wilson of Pennsylvania said, and I'm quoting, "In districts as large as the states, the number of people was the best measure of their comparative wealth. Whether therefore wealth or numbers were to form the ratio, it would be the same," end quote. There were two exceptions to the rule that tax capacity followed population. First, some states contained a substantial number of Indians who were governed exclusively by their tribes. They didn't pay state taxes and would not pay federal taxes. Second, the framers recognized that on average, slaves produced far less, and therefore less tax revenue, than free people. This recognition that slaves produced less than free people had absolutely nothing to do with race. It was because slaves of any race could not sell their labor and talents on the free market. They were stuck in a centralized system of command and control, something like communism. Thus, the framers had to find a way to reduce the state's representation according to the proportion of its population held in bondage. Fortunately, the Confederation Congress already had done the work for them. In 1783, Congress studied the relative productivity of slave and free workers. It considered a lot of factors in its analysis. It considered the different incentives of enslaved people and free people. It considered the value of their respective output, which was much less among slaves because of poor incentives. Congress compared the respective costs of feeding and clothing, free and slave labor. Congress compared the ages at which young free people and slaves began working. At the time, interestingly enough, free children started working earlier than slave children. Congress considered the different climates in free and slave states, and the value of the imports and exports in free and slave states. And finally, Congress considered the fact that slaves were disproportionately confined to agriculture as opposed to manufacturing and other activities. Notice that race wasn't even on Congress's list. We're reminded of Thomas Jefferson's quotation of the Greek poet Homer, quote, "Jove fixed it certain that whatever day makes man a slave, takes half his worth away." As Jefferson knew, Homer was speaking of white slaves. In other words, the Three-Fifths Compromise was not a statement about race at all. It was a statement about the economic inefficiency of slavery. Critics contend that the Three-Fifths Compromise rewarded slave states. Actually, it punished them. It punished them with reduced congressional representation. It's true that the compromise also reduced a slave state's direct taxes, but that wasn't a particularly good deal for slave states, because except in wartime, Congress was expected to resort only to indirect taxes, a prediction that proved true for some years. Nearly all the framers and the founders understood that slavery was evil. But as I explained earlier, they had to come to terms with it if they hoped to hold the Union together. Failure would have led to a fractured continent and European-style internecine war. But let's not make more of the framers' concession than the facts dictate. The Three-Fifths Compromise wasn't an endorsement of or a subsidy for slavery. It was based on a finding that slavery was economically stupid as well as unjust. Thanks for listening. I'm Rob Nadelson.